the headlines this hour. Tehran slams the International Atomic Energy Agency after it raises concerns over what it calls covert changes to equipment at Iran's Fordo uranium enrichment plant. Israeli forces raid the Kabat Jaber refugee camp as part of intensified Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. And deepening political crisis in Peru, Congress rejects another bill by the president to advance elections to quell weeks of unrest. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran has denounced the UN nuclear watchdog over its Wednesday report that has raised concerns over changes to equipment at a nuclear site. Iran's nuclear chief, Mohammad Islami, says the IAEA report is based on a mistake by an inspector during a visit to the Fordo plant. Tehran has written to the agency explaining the inspector's mistake, but the agency publicized the issue. The Iranian official criticized the agency's behavior as unprofessional and unacceptable. Islami has warned that such practices would harm IAEA's reputation. The U.S. and its European allies have issued a joint statement accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They have found Tehran's response to the agency inadequate. Tehran says a comprehensive cooperation agreement between Iran and Venezuela is a turning point in relations between the two countries. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is visiting Caracas, made the remarks during a meeting with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Amir Abdollahian said implementation of bilateral deals with Caracas would boost ties further. Maduro, for his part, said the experience of the two countries in dealing with shared issues necessitates strengthening relations. The two sides also stressed the need to stand up against foreign pressure and to defend their national interests. Amir Abdollahian earlier held talks with Venezuela's vice president, among other top officials, and discussed ways to strengthen ties in different fields. We've talked to political commentator Masoud Shajare about the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Caracas. He says the trip can be viewed as part of efforts to chip away at U.S. hegemony across the world.
For countries like Venezuela and Iran, who are both target of arrogance of U.S. Hegemony and sort of illegal, unlawful sanctions and pressures, why is it that they haven't really gone further in past? But it really is a breath of fresh air. The reality is that there is the illusion that has been created in the world that who is the international community? I mean, if you ask who is the international community, usually what they try to elude us all is a small handful of countries, including United States, Canada, Australia, Europe, all white European so-called elite, that they think that they represent the international community. And indeed, those countries need to come together to stop this illusion that the international community or this handful of Western nation under the hegemony of United States.
13 Palestinians have been injured in the Akabat Jaber camp in the occupied West Bank, where Israeli forces have surrounded a Palestinian home. The regime soldiers have reportedly stormed the camp with heavy machinery. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details.
For the sixth consecutive day, Israeli forces had been imposing a curfew or a closure on the Aqbat Jaber refugee camp in Ariha because the Israelis claim that a Palestinian opened fire at an Israeli restaurant near illegal settlement built in Ariha. The Israelis claim that this Palestinian who opened fire is originally from Aqbat Jaber refugee camp. every day Israeli forces raid Aqaba Jabr and prevent Palestinians to move freely. But what's happening since the early hours of this morning is that Israeli forces raided Aqaba Jabr, surrounded a house there. They claim that the Palestinian who opened fire at a restaurant is from Aqaba Jabr, and they are ordering his father and brothers to hand their son to the Israeli forces. As we are receiving now, all the entrances of Ariha, the main roads leading to Ariha, not only Aqaba Jabr, are completely closed. Israeli forces are not allowing anyone to enter or to leave the area. Three Palestinians had been wounded during this operation. And it seems that the Israeli forces insist to arrest this Palestinian before leaving Aqaba Jabr and Ariha.
China has accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. The Chinese foreign minister issued a statement after the U.S. Secretary of State canceled a planned trip to the country over allegations that Beijing flew a spy balloon over the U.S. China had already expressed regret over the issue, blaming winds for pushing what it called a civilian airship into U.S. airspace. On Saturday, China further said that it never violated the territory and airspace of any sovereign nation. The ministry also emphasized the need for maintaining communication channels at all levels to deal with some unexpected situations. Antony Blinken issued a personal note to his Chinese counterpart after the discovery of the balloon over the U.S. state of Montana.
In my call today with Director Wang Yi, I made clear that the presence of this surveillance balloon in U.S. airspace is a clear violation of U.S. sovereignty and international law, that it's an irresponsible act, and that the PRC's decision to take this action on the eve of my planned visit is detrimental to the substantive discussions that we were prepared to have.
Blinken further said that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. In the meantime, the Pentagon said it had spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing had already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. Emmanuel Pastrike is the president of Asia Institute. He says the U.S. is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China.
Essentially, we have a system which is out of control. And now, sadly, this relatively tiny group of people within the military and the arms contractors are making policy for the entire country, feeding it to the politicians, and they have really no brakes on them. They're going, in the case of Ukraine, basically any weapon, except for nuclear weapons so far, although that might come soon, is being fed. In the case of China, a country, I think as a whole, Chinese have a relatively positive view of the United States. Many Chinese have family in the United States. It was not a hostile relationship, but billions and billions of dollars are being poured into making it, hyping it up to be some sort of enemy. And Blinken's trip is totally logical. He should go very frequently, canceling it over this one minor matter out of, you know, thousands of similar ones, really shows us that the whole system is falling apart. The wheels are coming off of the cart.
Peru's Congress remains divided over President Dina Boluarte's bid to advance the general elections. Boluarte moved the proposal in an attempt to end the unrest that sparked after she assumed office about 2 months ago. Protesters in Peru are demanding her resignation in addition to early elections and constitutional reforms.
The political crisis deepens in Peru, where the legislative body has rejected President Dina Boluarte's bid to move elections to this year. Congress shelved the bill due to objections raised in a meeting of the Constitutional Committee on Friday. The matter is unlikely to be discussed before July, when Congress begins its new session. Lawmakers had previously agreed to move the date of the elections from 2026 to April 2024, but it could not calm the protesters. Blarta thinks the reschedule of the voting to this year might help mitigate unrest and chaos. The South American country has been in the grip of unrest since early December. There have been frequent clashes between protesters and police in several cities, almost on a daily basis. Confrontations have resulted in dozens of deaths. Apart from early elections, Peruvian protesters also demand President Boluarte step down.
We are outraged by the injustice that is happening, by the police repression, by the deaths, by the lack of justice. Also because the people are demanding the resignation of the president.
However, Boluarte has defied the calls accusing those demanding her resignation of pursuing political blackmail.
My resignation is not at stake in this situation. There is a minority of the population, of these groups that are generating violence and chaos in the country, who are pushing for my resignation in a blackmailing manner. And we are not going to give in to this political blackmail.
The protests have also taken a heavy toll on the country's economy, with workers being hit hard. The unrest has negatively affected transport of goods and the operation at key mines, which are major sources of income for the Andean nation. The protesters around the country have blocked highways, causing shortages of food, fuel, and other essentials in several regions. Hundreds of trucks remain stranded at the border with Bolivia, awaiting the end of a strike called by the protesters.
We are suffering every day. There's nothing to eat. Look how the roads are. You can't even walk, no motorcycle, no car, nothing. Dina Boluarte's government do not pay attention to what the people are demanding. What more do they want? How many more deaths?
Peru's unrest has been propelled mainly by indigenous people from the south. That's where ousted President Pedro Castillo comes from. He was removed from office and arrested in early December as he was attempting to shatter Congress to stave off his impeachment. The demonstrators demand his release because they regard Castillo as the one who can fight poverty and inequality. It seems that the fundamental problems driving the unrest will not go away, as the protesters are not only angry over stark inequality, but they feel neglected by state institutions, especially Congress, which many Peruvians say are being run by corrupt lobbies and vested interests.
An increasing number of Italians are feeling the crunch of inflation and raising interest rates. But the misery does not end there, as the prospect of a bleak future also looms large. Our correspondent Max Civelli has this report from Rome.
The recent decision by the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a further 0.5% has thrown Italian families and small and medium entrepreneurs into the depths of gloom. Prices in Italy rose 8.1% year-on-year in 2022, hitting a 37-year high. Now, Italians see themselves stuck between a rock and a hard place. The country's inflation rate had shot up to around 12% in the months between October and December, a trend also seen across Europe. This is due to soaring energy and food prices linked primarily to the conflict in Ukraine and the related rearmament spending that all members of the bloc are engaged in. But it's also caused by the governments having thrown support packages worth hundreds of billions of euros at the corporations and the rich over the past years.
High inflation, soaring energy bills are biting hard. In addition to that, our average salaries have not kept up pace, and they have not gone up for years. It's really worrying.
Quite simply, I went to buy food at the supermarket last week, and this I usually buy for 30 euros costs me about 50 euros instead.
Although inflation rates have recorded a clear abatement across Europe, Italy is still dealing with two-digit inflation, which stands at over 10%.
The European Central Bank's latest rate hike has brought to 3% the total of interest rate increases over the past 6 months. The EU's governing council is expected to raise them further next month.
These moves by the ECB adopted to slow inflation don't seem to have worked very much so far. The problems affecting our economy seem to be rather structural, and this situation has led citizens and businesses to lose confidence in a real recovery.
According to a survey of some 27,000 citizens commissioned by the European Parliament, more than 9 out of 10 of Europeans are very concerned about the rising cost of living. 40% of the people living in the EU feel they are already struggling to pay for food and other basics, and almost 1 in 2 says the standard of living has fallen. But more worryingly, they are not holding out much hope for the future either, as another 39% expect the standard of living to fall this year. Max Civili, Rome.
A senior Russian official warned that the supply of more advanced U.S. weaponry to Ukraine would just add fuel to the fire, culminating in more retaliatory strikes from Russia. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, says in case Ukraine receives new weaponry, all regions remaining under its rule will also burn. He added that the use of longer-range weapons by Ukraine and its allies won't force Russia to hold negotiations. Medvedev emphasized that Russia is ready to use all types of weapons in accordance with their doctrinal documents. The Pentagon announced on Friday that it was sending Ukraine a new military package worth $2 billion. Russia has time and again reiterated that more military aid to Kiev would only prolong the war and add to the suffering of Ukrainians. Sri Lanka marks its 75 years of independence, celebrating the end of British colonial 48. A military parade was held in the capital, Colombo, to commemorate the occasion that was attended by top officials, including its president. During a speech, the president called on the nation to reflect on past errors and to rectify failures. The ceremony was boycotted by opposition parties, while activists expressed anger at what they called a waste of money at a time of severe economic crisis. The island nation has been the scene of widespread protests triggered by an economic crisis last year. The protest movement peaked in July, when people stormed the home of the former president for him to flee the country. The protesters then blamed the government for its worst economic crisis since its independence. Sri Lanka is still coping with the shortage of essentials. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 13th of Rajab, the birthday anniversary of the Commander of the Faithful and the Leader of the Pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is also Father's Day. We congratulate all Muslims on this auspicious occasion.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, Brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa azami sifatika wa asma'ik an taj'al awqati min al-layli wal-nahari bi-dhikrika ma'mura بخدمتك موصولا وأعمالي عندك مقبولا حتى تكون أعمالي وأورادي كلها وردا واحدا وحالي في خدمتك سرمدا.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing this excerpt of the Divine Kumail Supplication. Ya Rabbi, Ya Rabbi, Ya Rab, As'aluka bihaqqika wa qudsika wa a'zami sifatika wa asma'ik. My Lord, I ask you by your truth, your holiness, and the greatness of your tributes and names, an taj'ala awqati min al-layli wa al-nahar bi-dhikrika ma'mura, that you make my times in night and the day inhabited by your remembrance, wa bi-khidmatika mawsula, and joined to your service, وَأَعْمَالِي عِنْدَكَ مَقْبُولَةٌ, and my acts acceptable to you, so that all my acts and my prayers may all be a single litany, حَتَّى تَكُونَ أَعْمَالِي وَأَوْرَادِي كُلُّهَا وِرْدًا وَاحِدًا. We mentioned some of the conditions of acceptance of our deeds, and we also explained that our traditions, our supplications and whispered prayers of the Ahlul Bayt are replete with instances of the Ahlul Bayt introducing us these conditions and prerequisites. We mentioned that the most important thing, or sometimes even the definition of acceptance of our deeds, is sincerity, doing the action merely for the sake of Allah and no one else. Now, sincerity has got many facets and aspects, one of which is sincerity in love of the Almighty Allah. In the previous episode, we tried to address one important question. From where should we draw this love of the Almighty Allah? Briefly answering to that question, we mentioned that Allah Himself is the source of this love and its origin. But the point is that there are some different categories to be mentioned regarding this question. The first point, what we explained in the previous episode, was that Almighty Allah is the one who loves His servant. The second point that we were explaining was the fact that Almighty Allah is the one who confers upon His servants His love and affection. In the Munajatul Mu'tasimeen, or those who seek refuge, he alayhi salam, Imam Zain al-Abidin says, I ask you to assign over us a protector through which you will deliver us from the destructions. Turn aside from us blights, and hide us from the striking of great afflictions, and to send us some of those tranquility, to wrap our faces in the lights of love for you, to give us heaven in your strong pillar, and to gather us under the wings of your protection by your mercy and your clemency, O most merciful of the merciful. Again, in the Munajatul Zahideen, or the Abstainers, he alayhi salam says, O Allah, induce us to renounce it and keep us safe from it by your giving us success and by your protecting us from sins. Strip from us the robes of opposing you and attend to our affairs through your good sufficiency. Amplify our increase from the boundless plenty of your mercy.
Ah, 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 ah. my Lord, oh Lord, oh Lord. I beseech you by your glory and honor, by your supremely high attributes, and by your names, to cause me to utilize my time day and night in your remembrance by engaging myself in serving you, and to let my deeds be acceptable to you, so much so that all my actions and offerings may be transformed into one continuous and sustained effort, and my life may take the form of constant and perpetual service to you, oh my Master, oh you upon whom I rely, oh you unto whom I express my distress.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true. Feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Also, in the supplement mentioned by Sayyid ibn Tawus to the supplication of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arafah, the Imam alayhi salam supplicates to Allah with these verses: how can your existence be proved through him who is dependent on you? Does other than you have an appearance which you do not possess, such that he would become the one to expose you? When you have become invisible, such that you have needed a proof to point you out? And when have you been so far away, such that the effects and athar would lead us to you? Blind is the eye which does not see you watchful over itself. And the ideal of one whom you have not given a share out of your love is in loss. Guide me to your light. Make me stand before you with true servanthood, and protect me through your protected secret, and make me travel on the roads of the people of attraction. O Allah, suffice me from planning for myself through your planning for me, and from my choice through your choosing for me, and keep me away from cases of anxiety and restlessness. These are the parts of Imam Hussein alayhi salam explaining how important this sincerity is. These are the signs of sincerity seen in the supplications, in the whispered prayers of Ahlul Bayt, and in this case, in the supplication of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Arafah. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
To you through heart, my Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Dutch Prime Minister recently apologized for his country's colonial past and the enslavement mandated by the Dutch state from the 17th to 19th century. Now, in his remarks, which were met with cynicism, he said that slavery must be recognized in the clearest terms as a crime against humanity. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the so-called apology by the government of the Netherlands over the country's role in slavery and the slave trade. Many are skeptical of the apology and are demanding full reparations to the descendants of slaves. In the second part of our program today, we are discussing the historical move by Zimbabwe to ban the exports of unprocessed lithium ore in a move aimed at encouraging value addition. So stay with us as our experts give us their insight on today's subjects.
Africa needs reparations for slavery. Last December, the Dutch Prime Minister officially apologized for 250 years of the Netherlands' involvement in slavery. The apology comes almost 150 years after the end of slavery in the European countries' overseas colonies. The current wealth of the Dutch was accumulated through the evil transatlantic slave trade. This European power is believed to have shipped over 600,000 Africans as part of the slave trade, mostly to South America and the Caribbean. In Asia, at least 1 million people were traded in areas under the Dutch East India Company.
The Prime Minister of St. Martin, an autonomous state within the Kingdom of the Netherlands in the Caribbean, is skeptical of the apology. She says her state will not accept nor deny apologies for the slavery from the Dutch government.
In our many discussions since September 6th, when the first meeting was forced to hear us, it was explained that this is not the way from our side, that this is not the way to properly dialogue on a topic of such enormous proportions. Repeatedly, this sentiment has been conveyed that it is in poor taste to move full steam ahead with an apology before proper dialogue has taken place, without proper respect for the feelings of the people who you want to apologize to, the descendants of those who endured, as was mentioned here today, the most devastating crime against humanity.
Well, for more on the so-called apology by the Netherlands over its slave trade crimes, we have contacted Tunde Osazua, a member of the Africa team at the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, why has the Netherlands decided to apologize for engaging in the evil slave trade at this point in time?
It was a response to a report published by a government-appointed advisory board. That board had recommendations, including the government's apology and recognition that the slave trade and slavery from the 17th century until abolition were crimes against humanity. And the report said that what it called institutional racism in the Netherlands can't be separated from centuries of slavery and colonialism and the ideas that arose in that context. Also, that apology comes at a time when countries' brutal colonial histories have received critical scrutiny because of the police killing of George Floyd in the U.S. in May 2020, and the movement that was birthed in the aftermath of his death.
African academics and ancestors of slaves say Western countries that were involved in the slave trade and other colonial-era crimes should not only offer apologies, but also pay reparations to affected countries.
Yes, they should absolutely pay reparations. The loss of human life from the African continent and diaspora due to the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism at a real cost. Africa and African people weren't just deprived of lost manpower and income, but also creativity, innovation, and relationships. And, you know, those losses were multiplied by millions of lives over hundreds of years, which really stunted their development.
The Prime Minister of Sint Maarten says financial aid should not be conceived as reparations.
That financial aid and loans provided thus far by the Netherlands can and should never be conceived of as part of reparations owed as a result of the expected apology.
The Netherlands says it is offering only a 200 million euro fund for initiatives to help address the legacy of slavery, insisting that it will not pay reparations. Now, what's your take on this decision?
Well, I think we should look at the case of Suriname, the small South American country where Dutch plantation owners generated huge profits through the use of enslaved labor. In Suriname, the largest opposition party, the NDP, condemned the Dutch government for failing to adequately consult descendants of enslaved people in the country. And, you know, what we understand is, you know, what's really needed is compensation, right? It's not just this apology. If you chalk up the billions of hours the enslaved Africans worked on Dutch plantations and pay that at a living wage, and you, you know, tally up the compensation of the millions of souls that were sacrificed to famine as a result of Dutch colonization.
The Netherlands usually celebrates Christmas with a controversial blackface figure accompanying Saint Nicholas, and many people consider it deeply offensive and a legacy of racism in this European country. Activists say this is a form of racial stereotyping and institutional racism prevalent in the Netherlands.
It's more than Swart Piet. It's about power, you know. Who get to decide who is Dutch or not? Who get to decide whether we're going to uphold a racist tradition or not? And who get to decide what is racism or not? So we are talking about identity also. We are talking about whatever slavery has manifested into our souls as today, how we behave towards one another.
The apology by the Netherlands Prime Minister came after a report found that people within the Dutch Foreign Ministry had been exposed to racist comments, and some were even passed over for promotion due to their skin color or ethnic origin. With such reports, is the apology in itself seen as an act of hypocrisy?
Absolutely. The apology is definitely an act of hypocrisy when these states, like the Netherlands, refuse to make any material impact or change as, you know, acknowledging that they've done wrong along with that. As Frantz Fanon once wrote, right, the wealth of imperialist countries or nations is our wealth. You know, Europe is literally the creation of the third world. So, you know, if we understand that colonialism built Europe's wealth, then total repayment would mean giving it up and changing these conditions that allow for, you know, racist comments, you know, the passing over for promotion and other, you know, I guess, impacts or effects of you know, racist ideologies. And so, I mean, as I think as long as, you know, there is a gap in wealth between, you know, the colonizing European countries and the colonized countries in the global South, in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, you know, these apologies, like what the Netherlands did recently, will be acts of hypocrisy.
Some African academics say that no material compensation can ever be enough for crimes of slavery, apartheid, or genocide. So it's better to accept apologies and move on.
You know, slave traders had no trouble pricing a human life, and abolition-era economists repaid slave owners for the losses of their freed slaves. It seems that it's only when the descendants of those slaves, those negatively impacted by colonialism. Only when they return to ask for compensation does counting become difficult. When they're trying to receive some sort of, compensation for their lost ancestors, that's only when things become difficult. But I don't think that that's where we should stop. We should press on and push until we win those full, honest, and courageous reparations that we deserve as colonized people.
Last year, a four-day summit on the theme Advancing Justice, Reparations, and Racial Healing was held in Accra, Ghana. Speaking during the summit, President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana said reparations for Africa and the African diaspora are long overdue.
We believe the calls for reparations to Africa are just. The effects of the slave trade have been devastating to the continent and to the African diaspora. You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized. Africa and her peoples lost out tremendously in that period, and its ripple effects are still being felt right till this very day.
The movement for reparations to countries and descendants of slavery has been gaining momentum over the recent years. Now, what needs to be done to compel European powers to start gradual reparations?
A powerful movement for reparations for centuries of slavery and colonialism, that movement needs to be built. And, you know, movement building is difficult work. It takes being in the streets with the people, developing real relationships and building unity around, these issues, as well as a joint plan of action. And so, you know, that movement building work hasn't really taken off. I think there needs to be more effort and attention placed on that movement building work. It has to connect, you know, Africa and the diaspora to create like a worldwide crusade for reparations for the African and Black world as a whole. And so I think if we want, you know, these European powers to take us seriously, to, you know, actually start with reparative justice, you know, what it takes is the building of a transnational reparations movement that's strong and has some leverage.
Well, there you have it. Our analyst there says that Africans and people of African descent should unite and create a transnational reparations movement to compel European powers to pay for their crimes. I'd like to thank Tunde Osazua for his incisive analysis today. And we now take a short break before our next topic on the historic move by Zimbabwe to ban the export of raw lithium so that it can cash in on value addition. Stay with us.
Zimbabwe stops lithium plunder.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Zimbabwe has banned the export of raw lithium with immediate effect. The Southern African country has the largest lithium reserve in Africa, but European and North American companies and smugglers have been extracting the valuable ore without paying their dues.
The growing global demand for electric vehicles and renewable energy has seen Chinese companies investing in lithium mining in recent years. A Chinese firm has purchased a lithium mine near Harare, a move that authorities in Zimbabwe believe will halt the plundering of this country's lithium by Western multinationals.
Speaking during the commissioning of the lithium processing plant in Bikita, Zimbabwean President Emmerson Mnangagwa said that such value addition projects will have win-win benefits for all. Well, to discuss Zimbabwe's historic move to ban the exportation of unprocessed lithium, we have contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist. Now, what will be the impact of Zimbabwe's decision to ban the export of raw lithium ore?
Which is good. Zimbabwe is looking at harnessing the value from lithium to be able to empower its industrialization, to be able to empower its energy needs. And this is in line with the African mining vision aspirations. The African mining vision looks at enriching minerals within Africa contribute to structural transformation of African economies. So Zimbabwe, by doing that, is actually just implementing the aspirations of the African mining vision, and it's very good. Again, the consequence is that Zimbabwe is now showing a story, telling the reality that yes, it can work and be able to end the continued dependence of the global west, of the West and North America and Europe on Africa for raw materials.
The European Union and the US have been exploiting Africa's lithium mines and leaving African countries poorer. It is expected that Western powers will resist Zimbabwe's move, like they reacted to a similar move by Indonesia, claiming it breaches international trade rules.
So yes, I foresee, of course, threats. The EU is known to be a threat. It has used a number of sanctions on African countries to make them accept unfair terms of trade, but also unfair policies, make them change their economic policies and even social policies. It might start threatening. That is most likely. It might start now. It might go in the EU Parliament and vote, maybe sanction Zimbabwe or something. That is most likely to happen, even the European Development Fund, the EDF.
Western companies have been exploiting Africa's lithium mines and leaving the countries poorer, only to come back and sell them processed minerals in the form of smartphones, car batteries, and other rechargeable electronics.
In a bid to stop this exploitation, Zimbabwe has partnered with China and is now one of China's closest partners on the African continent. Now, this has led to anti-China rhetoric in Western media outlets. The Zimbabwean vice president has responded to this Western propaganda.
We get some uninvited voices talking about the friendship between the People's Republic of China and Zimbabwe, trying to blacken what has been achieved through the help from the People's Republic of China. So that in misinformation, disinformation, no matter how they will scream or shout, it is not going to destroy that comprehensive strategic partnership between the two people.
Others have interpreted Zimbabwe's move as beneficial to China and detrimental to Western powers that have imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe. Now, do you agree with this?
This is all about neocolonialism. This is all about imperialism. This is all about really Africa being a testing ground where all the emerging powers and the rich countries are flexing their muscles in terms of controlling Africa. Whether it is a threat, yes, it is a threat, of course. China is a threat to the United States.
Zimbabwe Mines Minister Winston Chitando says lithium export ban will ensure that the vision of the president to see the country becoming an upper-middle-income economy has been realized. Many Zimbabweans are hopeful that they will benefit from this historical decision. However, experts warn that the government needs to put mechanisms in place to ensure the country does not fall victim to the resource curse prevalent in Africa.
Unfortunately, there has always been a resource curse, not only in Africa, in every country, majority of the global south, really. Areas where these resources are found end up not benefiting. Actually, there is a lot of human rights violations and environmental destruction, displacement, sometimes there are civil wars, corruption, and all that. So there is a lot that the government of Zimbabwe needs to do. And to me, two or three things. One is investing the resources in social services.
Zimbabwe's ban on the exports of unprocessed lithium in 2022, followed by banning the exports of all raw mineral ores this year, is seen as a new wave of resource nationalism. The country is poised to immensely benefit from these decisions. An official at the new lithium processing plant explains.
This lithium resource will put Zimbabwe on the map as one of the premium suppliers of lithium into the world lithium battery market.
Do you think other African countries with strategic minerals such as nickel, graphite, cobalt, and lithium will follow in Zimbabwe's footsteps and ban the export of unprocessed minerals? Or in other words, are we going to see a rise in resource nationalism and the end to the plunder of the continent's resources by Western multinationals?
If I was to create an utopia, I would say yes. I see African countries following Zimbabwe's stance of resource nationalism, putting an end to export of raw materials. But I don't see that is just an utopia. It's a fantasy. It can't happen. Africa remains undivided ever, more than ever, actually, when it comes to speaking with one voice, when it comes to implementing visions jointly.
Well, unfortunately, our time is up for today. Our guest there says that Africa needs to unite if the continent is to fully benefit from its vast mineral resources. I would like to apologize for the low quality voice of our guest. I'd like to thank Africa Kiza for his insight today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.